Coming up, Snap is below its IPO price. Another venture partner resigns over misconduct. Uber hands over control in one of its international markets. And WeWork is worth $20 billion. Welcome to Equity. I'm TechCrunch's Katie Roof, and my colleague Matthew Lindley is off today. But we still have Alex Wilhelm, Crunchbase News Editor-in-Chief, and our special guest this week is Matt Murphy from Menlo Ventures.
It's been a good kind of big week. We have four main topics, so we'll have to chop them up a little bit for you all. But my favorite story from the last week is I'm watching the share price of Snap, the former darling, the Q1 IPO darling of the tech industry, go through some kind of rough waters. And if you haven't been reading the news too carefully, I'll just kind of break it down really quickly. Snap priced its IPO at $17 a share, a little bit above its last private valuation. Everyone thought that was pretty good. Pretty solid. Opened at $24 on its first day, which was huge, and then shot as high as $29.44, and then had a bit of a rough earnings report and has since seen some undercuts from different analysts, including one bank that underwrote its IPO, and this week fell down not just to 17, but below that price, and is now, I think, about 20% beneath its IPO price. Maybe it's just 15, but it's been a shock. You know, people really thought this was the next rocket ship. So what do we think about this, and why is Snap getting hit up now?
Well, yeah, and that bank was Morgan Stanley, as you know, and but it is important to remember that there is a wall at these banks. The research is completely separate from the banking side, and so technically they are supposed to be making independent decisions that have nothing to do with their underwriters. But still, it's bad news for Snap to get downgraded by a firm like Morgan Stanley. But yeah, I think, I don't know if they were ever really a darling of tech. I mean, or at least not in terms of earlier this year. I don't think anyone really was that optimistic about their IPO, or at least most people weren't.
I think we in the media were very pessimistic, but I think on the investing side, there's a lot of optimism. I mean, they grew like 400% last year.
Yeah, and I think that this was kind of supposed to be the big bang moment for the IPO market, the return of the big high-flying, you know, consumer company. And let's be realistic, it's still worth a ton. And sometimes at this stage of a consumer company, the valuation's a little bit arbitrary and things always get a little bit choppy as you approach the lockup date. So I think that's part of what's going on. I think the other thing that people probably underestimated around the time of the IPO was how quickly Facebook iterates and copies, or whatever word you want to use if you don't want to use copy, mimics, but they really do. They are amazing at product velocity, one of the best out there. And if you look now at Instagram, Instagram's got 250 million users versus Snap's 166 in their latest report.
You mean just on stories, right? That's 250 million monthly uniques on stories.
Stories.
Yeah, because Instagram itself is bigger than that in aggregate.
Okay.
I think so, yeah.
I think that was total MAUs. At least I thought it was, but we can check that. But anyway, my point is Instagram's already bigger and it's growing faster and it's doing an amazing job of replicating some of the really differentiated Snap features. The other thing about that they're putting the squeeze on Snap is they're giving away the filters, right? And that's half of Snap's revenue. So when you start to kind of sit there and look as an investor in Snap, okay, Instagram's bigger, growing faster, and giving away half of the economic model. How do they navigate around that? So I think it's the combination of that and this lockup coming.
Sure. Again, in earlier this year, my point was we already knew that Instagram had copied Snap and their growth had slowed significantly. And so that's why I personally wasn't optimistic about the IPO.
That's fair. But I mean, going back to the idea of what it's worth and how it can be arbitrary, you know, I looked at the numbers of this, and this is actually from yesterday. So these numbers are one day behind. But Twitter is worth about 5.4 times its trailing revenue, roughly. Facebook, your execution machine, I think was your phrase, about 15 times trailing revenues. Snap, even with all these declines, is still about 36 or 37 times trailing revenues. So even with these massive, you know, reductions in its value, its multiples are still incredibly high. So I'm curious if the Instagram story thing cancels its MAU growth and Instagram can take away its ability to drive revenue through these filters, how does it grow into that multiple without taking more shocks? I don't want to sound rude, but it sounds tough to me.
I think the multiples have compressed because of those kind of clouds on the horizon, but I think there's still enough optimism around what this service is. I mean, I have kids who are in the kind of the power age of users of this product, and it is the most iconic thing in the last 10 years for them. And so I think it has a tremendous amount of legs, and they're still working through their revenue model, and there's going to be some hiccups along the way, but everyone still knows if they nail that, they'll grow back into that valuation and more. So that's kind of the yin and the yang of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, their active users are very active. There's no question that teens and certain people are using this all day long. So they have built a product that a lot of people like, and they have shown an ability to innovate. I've said this before, but Twitter, on the other hand, they pretty much came up with one good idea, and they've really just modified on that one idea. But whereas Snap has come up with a few different good ideas. So there's a chance that they'll continue to innovate again and again. I mean, they had the disappearing messages, and they had the stories, they have the lenses, and then they have the Snap, they have the spectacles, which are the glasses that you can wear and upload stuff to Snapchat. So we'll see what they come up with next, but they could come up with the next big idea. It's not out of the question.
And that's a really good point, because I think if you look at Twitter stock as it fell from like mid-40s down to 14, like revenue was growing great, but just there was no user growth, and the market didn't believe there was a next big act. And I think that's the difference here with Snap, is that people really do believe they will have one, and they've shown they can.
Just as a last point before we move on, the criticism that I hear mostly is that Facebook is essentially stealing from Snap and Snapchat, the application itself, which is reasonable enough, even though I don't really buy the stealing argument in technology so much. But I saw some criticism this week that said, you know, Snap didn't invent these AR filters for your selfies. It isn't like Snap was the first company to come up with these. And so if you look back at some chat applications, I think from the Asian continent, they were earlier to this than Snap was. So all the angst some of the angst we see in the American market about, you know, is Facebook stealing from Snap, isn't looking far enough back on the genealogy tree of where this stuff comes from. And so I wonder if Facebook is just leveraging this platform effectively and not actually even being rude by taking what someone else already stole.
Yeah, and this isn't even the first time that Facebook's tried to copy them. They had various attempts over the years that failed miserably, but this time it stuck, and so they kept trying. But while it was successful on Instagram stories, I don't know anyone who uses, like, Messenger stories or Facebook stories. Like, it's pretty much only people who work at Facebook on my feed that are using it. So it worked on Instagram, but it's not working everywhere. So,
but it only has to work once.
Do people use WhatsApp stories? I don't know. I mean,
wait,
maybe
WhatsApp has stories, too?
Yeah, but maybe in international markets, but...
I didn't even know WhatsApp has stories.
Another topic we're unfortunately going to have to discuss again, because yet another partner has stepped down, Frank Artali at Ignition Partners, over allegations of misconduct. We're going to have to talk about sexual harassment in venture capital again, because it's clearly still a problem. Yeah, we just are hearing more and more people coming forward and feeling more comfortable sharing their reports of things that have happened to them before. And it seems like a wave that may not stop anytime soon. So what do you guys make of this?
Well, can you break us down? Do we know anything more about the allegations themselves? Do we have any context here about what happened? And we can kind of maybe vet the severity of it.
Right. So as for the official resignation statement, they were fairly vague. Reuters and some others had reported on the incident last year that there was a groping incident with a 20-year-old employee. So that doesn't sound good. It does not sound good. Obviously, it goes without saying that you should not grope your employees. I can't believe we have to say that. That's not something that women should have to deal with in the workforce or anywhere, really. What do you guys think? Do you think we're going to see a lot more of this in the coming weeks? Do you think we're going to see a lot more people stepping down? Do you think we're going to see venture firms changing their policies and having stricter oversight over behavior?
Answering your first question, there seemed to be a bit of a lull. It went kind of binary capital, 500 startups, and then there was a slight pause. It felt like, at least according to my internal timeline, and so to see this come up again keeps the wave going, as you said. And then the question then becomes, is it just three firms, or are we seeing four, five, and six come out here in the next couple of weeks? And I don't think I have a good pulse on that, because I don't have a good idea of how much more smoke there is right now.
I don't know if we'll see a lot more, but I think we'll see some more. I just feel like the velocity of which these things have come out there, you know, there has to be more. At the same time, you know, I think that, you know, I'm proud of a lot of the people I've worked with in this industry for a long time, and I generally think we have a lot of good actors. The vast, vast majority of this industry is filled with good actors, even, you know, better than other industries by far, probably. Not that that matters, because relative doesn't matter. If there are bad actors out there, they're bad actors. And I think it's great that this process that we're going through right now has enabled a set of reporters to find those bad actors. And it's also given women a voice to come forward and encourage them and enable them. And all of that is very positive. And I think, you know, that we are really all on the same side here. There's nobody who should be in this business who should ever use the position as investor to manipulate someone into any kind of a sexual situation or any kind of, you know, personal advantage. That's just horrible to think that anybody would do that. So I think we're all on the side of that being bad. I do think that, you know, we can get the dialogue going a little bit better. I feel like a lot of men, male partners in this industry are a bit kind of clammed up for fear of kind of some of the attacks that have happened on social media and how you think you were saying something thoughtful and you get crucified for being insensitive. And if somebody says something insensitive, they deserve to be crucified. Let me be clear with that. But I think that we're making progress here, and we want to have a more open mutual dialogue on how we get better together and make this industry better. Because we all know it's a very special industry. It's a global phenomenon of economic growth and wealth creation like it's never been before. This industry has become much more important, probably why we have the, you know, the lens upon us. And so that's a great honor for all of us who are part of it. We need more diversity, and we need to get there together.
What was the reaction at your firm? So when all this starts to break, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago?
Past few weeks.
You know, inside of your company now, how do you guys talk about this? Do you immediately do some soul searching? Is it just kind of an email chain? Do you guys talk about it personally? What goes on over on your digs?
I think, you know, from a policy standpoint, we kind of look and say, well, are we doing the right things, you know, both internally and with entrepreneurs that we interact with to make sure that, you know, nothing like this could ever, you know, would ever happen systematically. I mean, I think we believe we have a good group of ethical people and who would never cross those boundaries. And I'm quite confident of that. We do have, you know, sexual, you know, awareness training internally. And we do talk about things. We have a head of HR. And we've told everybody in the company that they don't feel like they have to come to the partner to report something. They can go directly to our head of HR. So even though we're sub 50 people and we don't need to do that, I think we've done a lot of things to be proactive. You know, certainly we supported the decency pledge and, you know, things of that nature and want to be part of, you know, raising awareness. I think, you know, part of it, you know, probably for everybody is there's a bit of shock that that it's gone on as much as it has and to the degree it has. And you know, when's the next shoe going to drop and who is it going to be? And you know, I'd hate to see it be somebody I know and respect and have worked a lot with. But if that's what the person's been doing, then they absolutely need to be outed. And I'd be glad that it happened.
There's no question that this isn't just a tech industry problem. I personally experienced very bad things right out of college when I was working in Hollywood. And so I know for sure that this is not the only industry that has these problems. But I do think part of the issue, and I've said this before, but there are not enough high-ranking women in the industry. And I think that makes it feel, for some men, they feel like they're not going to be held accountable. That's why the media has had to hold them accountable. Going forward, it's important that people recognize that they're not going to be able to get away with this. And I'm very sorry that we've had these huge fallouts at these venture firms, which obviously impacts a lot of people, not just the partners that resigned, but the other people on the teams, their families, the companies they invested in. So obviously this is a terrible way to have to address this, but because it wasn't addressed, that's why it's getting addressed this way. So hopefully going forward, it doesn't have to stay this way. But, you know, I wanted to ask you a little bit. I mean, you know, you came from Kleiner Perkins, where you dealt with the Ellen Powell scandal and all that, or the lawsuit. And I wanted to get your take. I mean, have you seen a change in this industry? Do you think we're going to see more women getting promoted and becoming venture partners? What do you think is happening there?
Well, I think we already have. You know, Sequoia added a partner, Benchmark added a partner. So I think there's a lot of progress. It doesn't happen overnight. We've been out in the market looking for a partner with a focus towards a female partner for the last couple of years, and we'll continue to lead that search. In fact, if you know any great people with a little bit more of a consumer bent, you know, we're looking. And we did add Janie Shaw, who's a very experienced kind of, you know, associate level out of PayPal and Venmo, and she's been a great addition to our team. So, you know, given that most firms' starting point is 90% male, it just takes time until we can really shift those ratios. But when you see high-profile firms starting to make progress and people proactively trying to make it happen, then, you know, that's a good sign. And I want us to, you know, kind of build on that and accelerate that and not have, you know, people's, you know, concern about open dialogue and discourse take anything away from that. And I think we are getting there. It's getting a lot better.
Does anyone disagree? Because I feel like whenever I talk to a VC about this, they mention some people that have made some changes and that they're trying to hire a more diverse team. There must be some holdouts. Or do you know of any, you don't have to name them, but do you have any VCs or groups or funds that are listening to this dialogue in the industry and saying, eh, not so much? Or is diversity now a priority everywhere in VC?
Oh, I think it's top of mind for most every firm. I mean, you can't put your head in the sand given everything that's going on right now and, you know, the kind of the court of public opinion around getting more diverse and is one side of it. And I think the other side of it is just, you know, awareness within partnerships that there's a certain set of entrepreneur that you're not going to be able to invest in that company unless you're a more diverse firm. And I think that's evolving more. And, you know, Katie, to your point, like what used to police this industry was reputation was everything. And I still believe that to be true. Like if you don't have a reputation, whether it's, you know, you're a great firm to work with, you're an impact player, all those things matter. You're good people to work with. And somehow this one issue for at least a few firms was hidden. And that's awful. And that's terrible. And I'm glad that people can come forward now. And absolutely, this should be part of your reputation. How do you treat people? How do you treat minorities? How do you treat women? How do you treat entrepreneurs in general that you're meeting with? And that has to be part of your reputation index, which is everything in winning deals, winning new ventures.
And these days, everyone has a social media platform or a Medium or whatever. I mean, as we saw with Susan Fowler at Uber, she was able to just discuss these allegations publicly, even though she wasn't in the media. So these days, I think it's easier to raise awareness about these issues. And so partly that I think that's part of the reason that we're hearing more and more about these things. But actually, there was some Uber news that
yes,
we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, we do want to talk about some Uber news, Uber being the perennial topic of this podcast. There's two. Well, I mean, perennial because Uber keeps doing stuff, both good and bad. So there's two big things out this week. One is that Uber had a call with a bunch of its investors and said that its gross bookings grew 10% sequentially in Q2. And I went ahead and pulled up the backwards numbers. We can compare that. And I think Uber grew by about 8.5%, 8.7% in Q1 gross bookings over Q4. So this was an increase in sequential growth on a percentage basis from a higher base, which is bullish. And the company said it lost less money. Now, the last number we have from Uber was a $708 million loss. I think that was in the first quarter of this year, but that's adjusted. That's no share costs, and a lot of other costs are excluded, like vehicles. So we don't actually know what their margins are, and given that they've changed their net revenue percentage over time, we don't really know what gross bookings means, but Uber grew some and lost less. So more as it comes, but that's kind of the current state of affairs. And then today, I think it was today, Uber kind of, I think the phrase we talked about before the show was folded its cards in Russia. I wanted to make a Trump joke that was shot down instantly by the crew.
I mean, you can make it.
Well, now it's not funny. It would have been funny like half an hour ago.
I laughed.
Yeah, you're the one who just always says you don't want to talk about politics on the show, and then you do. So I wasn't sure.
I'm totally lying. All I want to do is do a show about politics, and no one will let me because no one cares about anything about politics. But Uber is, we can just say, folding its Russian operations into Yandex, which when I saw this confused me because Yandex is best known as a Russian search engine, right? It turns out they operate Yandex.taxi. That was news to me. But I pulled the article. So the idea is the new entity that's combined, which will be pending regulatory approval, but it's Russia, so we'll see. We'll be valued at about $3.4 billion. Uber's putting in $225 million, Yandex putting in $100 million, and they'll get the majority. So it seems to imply that Yandex's Russian business was, in fact, larger than Uber's going into this deal. But to Matt's point from before the show, this is the second time in a major market that Uber has gone in aggressively, and I think we can fairly say spent a lot of money, and is now folding itself under the local player, while maintaining a stake and a non-controlling interest. So I don't know. That's the lay of the land. What do we think about this? And how's Travis feeling right now?
And you're an investor in Uber. We should disclose
Both through Menlo and Kleiner Perkins. So, you know, but I don't really have any privileged information on
oh, good. Then you can talk as much as you want. You cannot get in trouble then.
But look, I mean, one interesting upshot of this is somehow the company's operating in such a way without a CEO, CFO, and a full management team that they can put $100 million to work and make a decision like this. So that's kind of interesting.
Is that good or bad, though? Is that like a lack of controls or is that decisive action?
No, it sounds like they've been working on this for a while and they were able to kind kind of see it through. But coming up with $100 million off their balance sheet is, you know, material. And they were able to pull a, you know, a big trigger like that. So, look, I think Uber is getting to a mode where they do want to show more cash efficient growth. And, you know, if you're in a market like they were in China, where it's just too difficult to get there, you know, partnering up with somebody who's bigger and, you know, stronger than you and having a strong ownership in that that will accrue to you over time is a fine way to go. So I think they've got the view that they want to be dominant in every market in the world that they can be. But I think they're smart enough to know when you're not going to get there.
So what's next, though, at Uber? Right now, they don't have a CEO. So I'm wondering how they even made this decision. Was it the board? Obviously, it's the board. But I'm just curious how this all went down. And do you have any insight into that? Because I'm curious who's really running Uber, who's really calling the shots.
I don't. But a deal like this, of this nature, would have been going on for months. I'm sure the board was briefed on it. There was kind of a recommendation. And at this point, post-Travis, it was just really into the nitty-gritty details. And the board, you know, blessed it. So I think if something de novo came up like this, it'd be much harder to get your arms around doing it, given where they are right now. But
do you think we'll see this happen in other markets?
I don't know. I don't know exactly what their market share is in a bunch of other markets globally, but I know that China and Russia were, you know, ones where they were particularly up against a strong competitor. But I think most other major markets, they are the strong leader and doing just fine.
But we agree this is a retreat. I mean, Uber didn't go into these markets expecting to not be number one, right? They were always playing for first place. So this must be a disappointment to the company.
Yeah, I think it's a disappointment in the sense of Uber, you know, believes they kind of created this market. And when you create a market in any business, you're not thrilled when copycats come in and take that market from you. The Sammer Brothers model in Germany and all those kind of things.
Weren't they the guys behind the whole Rocket Internet conglomerate thingy?
Yeah. The Sammer guys, they copy everyone, right?
The German fax machine, I think it was called.
Yeah, exactly.
So copying in tech is not new. But so it seems like you can't be number one everywhere. I mean, in fairness, as much fun as it is to hate on Uber, you really can't be number one in every city. So I think, in every country. So it's really not surprising to me that there are some markets that they didn't fare as well. I think that's to be expected. But I'm wondering if we're going to see some, like, acquisitions so that Uber doesn't get to this point where they see a growing player in some of these regions and they swoop in and pick them up. I mean, there's, like, Careem in the Middle East, which is doing really well. I'm just wondering if there's certain regional players that they will buy so that they don't have to get to this point.
That's how it often happens. And, you know, for some reason, some of these companies, I think we're kind of in a different financing environment when maybe eBay and Groupon and companies like that rolled up international assets, where it's been stunning how much capital some of these small companies have been able to raise in their local markets, which makes it a lot harder to acquire them.
I mean, just on that point, I think is it pronounced Ofo or Ofo, the Chinese bike sharing company?
Raised, I heard all about them when I was in China recently.
Oh my gosh, they've raised $1.15 billion in two rounds this year. Right. And then their competitor, Mobike, has raised like $1 billion this year. That's a lot of money for bikes in one country.
But they use a lot of bikes and they have a lot of people.
I've been to China. It's a great place. It's huge. But I mean, that does, even given those parameters, it seems like a lot of capital to deploy locally that would be hard to break into externally. But also, it almost seems like there's too much capital in some circumstances. That's an entire VC fund by accident after a $400 million round earlier this year in like 2 months. I don't get it. I mean, that's a staggering sum of money that confuses me. And, you know, to that point, WeWork raised another huge chunk of money this week, adding to my confusion about if they're asset light or asset heavy. But
I think they've raised $740 million recently at a reported $20 billion valuation. So WeWork is the co-working space. For those of you who don't know, they have a lot of spaces all over the world. They're sort of a real estate play, but they're clearly venture backed, and partly because startups like to have their offices at a lot of these WeWorks, where if you're an up and coming startup and you don't want to pay as much rent, you can just have a WeWork membership, which varies depending on how often you use it. But So they're worth a lot. Should they be worth this much? What do you guys think?
It's hard to say exactly what the market is underwriting them in terms of their long-term potential, right? I mean, so on the one hand, like, commercial real estate's like a $15 trillion industry. I think that's a U.S. number. It's like enormous. But like the The five biggest REITs, which own a lot of the commercial real estate, are worth
REIT,
like six.
REIT, Real Estate Investment Trust, REIT.
About $65 billion, and I think the largest is worth $20 billion. So the largest REIT conglomerate of commercial real estate assets is worth $20, and that's what we work as has worked out.
Yeah.
And by the way, they own those buildings.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
They own them, and WeWork is leasing and making money off of, you know, the arbitrage between the lease and what they rent the lease out. They're not even like owning the underlying asset that has the, you know, appreciation value. So I haven't gotten my head completely around, you know, the valuations in this market, except that we are seeing a massive shift in terms of how people think about getting space, getting temporary space, and, you know, a much more granular splitting up of office space. For example, we're investors in a company called Breather that does it for much more, sure, you know, short-term time frame. So do you want an office for an hour? Do you want it for a day? Do you want it for a week? And that's really been taken off and is another great example of kind of this flexible real estate option.
Is that what that's used for, offices? Like, I don't know. I've seen ads where it's like a hotel room for an hour, and I wasn't really sure what that was for.
No. Katie Roof. What is your insinuation?
Nothing like that.
I didn't say that. I was just asking if that was what it was for.
You know, so here, I'll give you a perfect example. Perfect example. Remember when you were in college and they had all these recruiters come up and show on campus and they wanted to meet you in a creepy hotel room and it was kind of weird?
Yeah.
Well, now it's like they rent out a few breathers and they have people interviewing in a proper space.
No one asked me to meet them in a hotel room.
I had a lot of interviews in hotel rooms. It was really weird.
I had none. I actually didn't have any interviews or job prospects, but that's a different story. Going back to the valuation point, though, if you go to BuzzFeed and you look up the following headline, WeWork used these documents to convince investors it's worth billions. Natasha Tiku published a bunch of information WeWork was pitching to investors back in 2015, maybe 2014. So you can go see for yourself what they were pitching a couple years ago to get a $10 billion valuation and then ask yourself, is it now worth 20? You can kind of play the game that Murphy over here plays all day, which is what is it worth and what will it be worth next time? I don't know. Asset-light businesses worth $20 billion? It blows my mind.
At the end of the day, it's a series of cash flows. And if they can arbitrage out their lease costs for what they're charging, then, you know, somebody can create a model that says it's going to be worth a lot if you think about the entirety of the U.S. or the globe. So, I mean, you know, you can get there. You just have to believe a lot of things are going to happen at scale.
It's the law of Silicon Valley. All businesses are discounted cash flows, except for Elon Musk, who just does whatever the hell he wants.
All right. On that note, thanks for tuning in. Come back next week.
All right, everyone. We want to say a special thanks to our producer, TechCrunch's own Christopher Gates, our executive producer, Henry Picavet. Thank you to Katie Roof. Thank you to Matthew Lindley. And thank you to you for leaving us that 5-star iTunes review. That's Equity. We'll see you all next Friday.